people of Palestine. This week, we're looking at the recent pronouncements of the Canadian psychologist and conservative commentator, Jordan Peterson. Peterson's known for his critical views on feminism, but he's now turned his attention to Muslims. In a controversial video, he's urged Muslims to, as he puts it, stop regarding Christians and Jews as your enemies. But is the reality of his appeal aimed at just normalising Zionism? I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. Before that, though, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation into the background to Peterson's comments.
The Canadian academic Jordan Peterson has raised the ire of Muslims around the world with his latest video.
In the aftermath of the extraordinary Abraham Accords, which have laid out the possibility for peace between all the people of the book in an unprecedented manner. And I have something to say as an extension of all of this.
He then proceeds to lecture Muslims on opening up to other groups of people. He even suggests that they must begin pen pal relationships with different sects, including Jewish people. The caption for the video states clearly what the motive behind the video is. In the aftermath of the Abraham Accords, Dr. Jordan B. Peterson suggests that the Muslim community can set a historical example by reaching across the aisle and making contact with whom they regard as the enemy. What about the media platform which produced the video with Peterson? The Daily Wire has recently signed him for a substantial figure. It is managed on a day-to-day basis by Chief Operating Officer John Lewis, who is a former intelligence analyst in the U.S. Marine Corps. It also employs former U.S. military intelligence officer Wesley Schmidt in customer service analytics. One of the founders of The Daily Wire is Ben Shapiro, a well-known pro-Israel YouTuber. Shapiro is a friend of the U.S. Special Envoy for Economic Normalization, Ariel Lightstone, and has hosted several interviews to promote the Abraham Accords, including with admitted liar Mike Pompeo. Ben Shapiro once tweeted that Israelis like to build, Arabs like to bomb crap and live in open sewage. Prior to founding The Daily Wire, Shapiro was a Shulman Fellow at the controversial David Horowitz Freedom Center. His role was provided by Robert Shulman, a board member of the Friends of the IDF, who pumps millions into the building of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. The other founder of The Daily Wire, Jeremy Boring, was intimately involved in the Prager University project founded by Israel lobbyist Dennis Prager. The CEO of PragerU is Marissa Streit, formerly of the Military Intelligence Unit 8200 in the Israeli occupation forces. The current senior editor and researcher at PragerU is Richard Lim, who was previously deputy associate director at the White House and then went on to be a program analyst at the FBI. The Daily Wire not only shared Jeremy Boring with the PragerU project, but also funders. Both organizations were financed by fracking billionaires, the Wilkes brothers. The Wilkes brothers provided the seed funding for the Daily Wire and regular financial support for the PragerU. Dan Wilkes Foundation also lavished financial support on Liberty Council, which has a Stand with Israel campaign, which consists of tours of the apartheid state and includes briefings by Israeli government, military, business and academic leaders. Both Shapiro and the PragerU project have also enjoyed funding from the Bradley Foundation, which has financed a panoply of Zionist organizations, including ones involved in illegal settlement building in the West Bank. So, we see that the media organization behind Jordan Peterson's normalization video has considerable links to not only US, but Israeli intelligence.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Batul Sabeti. Batul is an energy engineer, human rights activist and political analyst based in London. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. Tell us about these Abraham Accords. I mean, you've previously pointed to military agreements between Israel and Morocco as far back as the 1960s. So what's new about these developments?
Well, the key thing that's new about them is the economic arrangements which go along with them, and in particular the attempt to economically integrate between Israel And some of the Middle Eastern countries, West Asian countries like the UAE, for example, the effectively Israeli and US client state, which is a dictatorship, as you'll know, and with the Saudis as well. I mean, there's a strong relationship with the Saudis being developed by the Israelis. And people, I guess, are sometimes surprised when you say that. They say, well, surely the Saudis are very critical of the Israeli state. Well, no, actually, they are part of this process of normalization. And there's been a process like that in the House of Saud for some considerable time. So this is about economic integration, and it's about trying to embed the state of Israel in the economies of other West Asian countries.
Mm. And Batul, I mean, as somebody from the region, I mean, what's your thoughts about this effort to integrate the economies of the Arab states with the Zionist regime?
Right. It's important that we look at the Abraham Accords in the context of the balance of powers on the ground. So America is increasingly shrinking from the region. It's losing its strategic importance to it because all of their plans have been thwarted one after the other by the resistance movements on the ground that have only been gaining strength. So when we look at the Abraham Accords, we need to see it within the context of the deal of the century that was put forward that supposedly alluded that it wanted to find a solution to the Palestinian issue. That was not actually the case due to the fact that there was not a single Palestinian representative that was present, and even the PA, which was born out of Oslo, rejected this deal. That shows you the extent to which it was just unfathomable in terms of, you know, supposedly coming up with a solution. Rather, what the Abraham Accords was about, as was just mentioned over here, was forming a kind of united, coordinated front on the ground, an alliance that could actually confront the resistance axis that has been against American hegemony and that has been jeopardizing their interests. If we see with Biden's recent visit to the Middle East, there's been a lot of talk over kind of the void that is now emerging as America is withdrawing from the region. So right now, America's focus isn't so much on leveraging resources. I mean, it's milked the region and it hasn't gained much from that in the past two decades. Rather, its main focus is on not allowing Russia and China to strategically benefit from the region. Mm. So it's important that as it's leaving, it leaves behind a kind of united coalition and force that could serve its interests, as obviously now the battle with America is shifting from the Middle East elsewhere with Russia, that is obviously threatening its the unipolar nature of American hegemony.
No, indeed, indeed. And when you refer to the PA, you're referring to the Palestinian
Authority. The Palestinian Authority,
yeah,
exactly.
Of course, yeah. David, just tell me, I mean, what do you make of this media company, the Daily Wire, that produced the Jordan Peterson video?
Well, it's a bit of a stunning investigation that's been done here. So all credit to the people who dug this up. So this is an organisation which you wouldn't necessarily have known about, and it's actually set up by this guy called Ben Shapiro, who has vile racist anti-Palestinian views. Its project is to support the Israeli foreign policy objectives, and normalization is a key part of that. So that we often think that media organizations, even right-wing media organizations, are something of a black box where you don't look into their politics. But it's very clear from the investigation that's been done here that this is a pushing Zionist interests, and Peterson appears on the face of it to be simply the latest face of Zionist normalization.
Mm. I mean, Batul, how do you think Muslims should respond to Jordan Peterson's message to them?
Right. So there's a very famous quote by a man called Ali ibn Abi Talib in which he says that there is a word of truth in which evil is intended by it. If we look at the Quran, there's a verse that says, O mankind, we created you of nations and tribes so that you may get to know one another. The best amongst you is the most pious, meaning that Islam's default position over here is go out, build links, ties, form relationships, but it needs to be on the basis of upholding key principles and values. Now, if you look at the essence of the Abraham Accords, what is it trying to fixate? It's trying to fixate one of the biggest shames to have occurred, and that is the dispossession of the Palestinians through the world superpowers colliding to dispossess them to fulfill their interests. That is what is being normalized. Further onto that, they are using the title of Abraham. Now, Abraham is known as the father of all three Abrahamic faiths, right? And he is known to be actually one of the most revolutionary figures to actually walk this earth with his message of actually standing up and challenging the unjust status quo. So it's almost like a lie so big, such as normalizing the Zionist regime, requires a name so big, such as Abraham, in order to kind of put it under that kind of moral guise, to justify it and to play around with perceptions so that people's minds get distorted.
Sure, of course, of course. I mean, just turning again, David, to the Daily Wire, I mean, you know, they've been employing people who previously worked for US military intelligence. Do you think that's an issue?
Well, yes. I mean, we've seen on this programme time and time again organisations which appear to be neutral or apolitical or present themselves as such, who have all sorts of people who've previously been in intelligence organisations, quite often Israeli intelligence organisations, but also the US and indeed in the UK. I mean, this is an issue. I mean, these are these are people who have learned skills when they were intelligence officers, which they will go on to apply when in their new posts. But it also raises the question about whether they still remain intelligence officers. I mean, one of the ways in which intelligence operates is that people are given cover positions in corporations while they still maintain an intelligence role. So we should raise those kinds of questions. Maybe it's the case these people have all retired, but equally they will remain and will retain links with their previous employers, whether that's Unit 820 in the State of Israel in the Zionist regime, or whether it's in the FBI or in the CIA. So these are, or the or military intelligence indeed. So these are really serious concerns, which seems to affect a whole range of organisations throughout civil society, not just media organisations, but a whole range more.
Yes, and you know, Unit 8200, if you just want to just briefly explain what that is.
Unit 8200 is the signals intelligence unit of the Zionist regime. So it's like GCHQ in the UK, or like the National Security Agency in the US. You know, the organisations with which, for example, Edward Snowden was associated.
Batul, I mean, do you think Jordan Peterson was just being mischievous when he was suggesting a pen pal system across sectarian lines, or do you think he was being genuine?
It's an interesting question of actually who is sowing the seeds of discord. If we look at even those who brokered the Abraham Accords, for example, America, right? Mm. It's these imperialist nations that actually seek to kind of weaponize and stoke the seeds of sectarianism, which are dormant within the hearts of average individuals, in order to serve their callous interests. Mm. Take, for example, the creation, the initiation and the funding of ISIS. You know, they considered ISIS to be this key strategic organization that could fight the line of resistance that had a kind of Shia characterization, if we're looking at that which is spearheaded by the Islamic Republic of Iran. So obviously ISIS fought the line of resistance under the sectarian notion, whereas if you look at how the resistance fought them, they fought them as part of the conspiracy of the American project for the region. So the point that I'm trying to allude to over here is that they are the ones that sow the seeds of these discords, and they make a non-issue to be an issue, and then they come and say, you're uncivilized, you know, you two need to come together to sort your house out, basically. And it's important that we also allude to the reality on the ground is that this is not an issue in the region. What is an issue is divide between the first world and the third world. The issue is a divide between the East and the West. As the capitalists, they gain monopoly over land, wealth and resources, whilst the people of this land are impoverished. These are the issues that we need to be talking about. These are the solutions that we need to be finding.
Well, we just have to pause there for a second. And of course, you know, the ISIS example is not a unique one, is it? But we just want to now have a look at this report on the Abraham Global Peace Initiative.
Another interesting link in the Peterson chain to the Abraham Accords is his connection with Israel lobby group, the Abraham Global Peace Initiative, based in his home country of Canada. The organization, which claims involvement in Morocco normalizing relations with Israel, was established to, quote, give strength to the Abraham Accords. The board of the Abraham Global Peace Initiative features General Moshe Yaalon, former Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, Minister of Strategic Affairs, and head of the Israeli military. It also includes Brigadier General Amir Avivi, former head of auditing for the Israeli military establishment, including the Israel Occupation Force and the Israeli military industries. Ralph Nurnberger was legislative liaison at the infamous Israeli lobby group AIPAC for many years and now graces the board of AGPI with his presence. Another Israeli military figure featured on the board of this normalization group is Colonel Kobi Marom, a former brigadier commander of the Israeli military during the failed occupation of South Lebanon. The former deputy chief of mission at the Israeli embassy, Dan Arbil, sits on the board too, alongside Yoel Hassan, a former president of the World Zionist Congress and personal counselor to Ariel Sharon. The British Israel lobby group, the Board of Deputies, even has a presence, with their vice president, Edwin Shuker, holding a position on the board of the AGPI. Flor Hassan Nahum, the mayor of Occupied Jerusalem and founder of the UAE Israel Business Council, is also present in this rogues gallery of board members. The Abraham Global Peace Initiative is also home to an assortment of current and former Canadian security personnel and the senior rabbi of the UAE, Dr. Eli Abadi. Peterson has consistently publicly supported the work of AGPI board member Richard Cravats. When Cravats accused members of the U.S. Congress who oppose U.S. military aid to the Israeli military of anti-Semitism, Peterson publicly supported this unoriginal Israeli lobby tactic and tweeted the sad excuse for an article by Cravats to his millions of followers. There are several very prominent supporters of Peterson within the AGPI. The founder, Avi Ben-Lolo, has written about the supposed campaign to silence the Canadian academic. Another board member, Mohamed Tahwidi, has heralded Peterson as, quote, one of the greatest, smartest and brightest scholars to ever contribute to human thought. He went on to tweet Peterson's message to Muslims with the hashtag Abraham Accords. It appears that Peterson has been enlisted as a cultural weapon in the war to integrate the economies of key Arab states with the Israeli one, a danger to all.
David, what do you make of the revelations in the film there about this Abraham Global Peace Initiative?
Well, I mean, we, over the last however many weeks we've been doing the show, every week we come across new Israel lobby groups we haven't heard of before, which are exposed as having covert or overt Zionist links. And here's another one, extraordinary. I mean, even in the process of researching this, we came across a further one which has got an almost identical name, which has got the Abraham Accords in its title and Peace Institute. And so there's a huge rash of these organizations set up to embed and further and lobby on the Abraham Accords. There are literally thousands of Zionist organizations all over the world. I mean, almost thousands in the UK itself, and certainly many thousands in the US. So it's a kind of whack-a-mole situation, isn't it, where we spot one organization and then a few days later there's another one and another one. And this really shows the huge effort that goes into this. It's not just Israeli intelligence and money and Zionist foundations. It's a huge effort which is internally networked. Muslim apparent scholars, of course, his credentials for being a scholar are extremely minimal, as you will have seen if you've read anything about him. And to try and present this as being what Muslims should do. They should get in bed with the Zionists. They should pretend that the Palestinians haven't been dispossessed. They should pretend that there's not ongoing ethnic cleansing and indeed a slow genocide in Palestine, and pretend that we can all be nice to each other. And this is not the way to produce peace or justice.
I mean, and they often sort of adopt benign sounding and worthy names, don't they? But that's sort of part of the subterfuge, no doubt. But Batul, isn't it interesting that this lobby group was seemingly established to strengthen the Abraham Accords? I mean, how did the resistance groups in the region respond to these machinations?
Right. The reality is that the resistance doesn't really get dragged to the squares that they want them to be dragged into.
No,
they have their own line, they have their own set of aims, and they have their own trajectory. And they respond to threats as they arise on the ground, and not political talks. Mm. It's actions on the ground that are threatening, whether it's economic, whether it's military, that they would respond to, and they will use the tools at their disposal for those objectives. But on a whole, the trajectory of the resistance is one of securing the interests for the people of the region. It's to ensure that the people of the region have their own independent voices and they can curate and craft their own destinies. Mm. So at the heart of this, we need to understand that this is why the resistance is actually being targeted, and actually the resistance is actually spearheading the real message of Abraham, which is one of dignity and freedom.
Indeed. I mean, David, the Global Peace Initiative works closely with the Canadian police and the security services there, doesn't it? It's a familiar tactic, isn't it? And it's been deployed by the Israel lobby in Britain. I mean, can you give us one or two examples of how they've kind of operated in Britain?
Well, I mean, the key examples in the US and in Britain are, in the case of Britain, the Community Security Trust, and in the case of the US, the Anti-Defamation League, which are kind of parallel organizations. So their main aim, they say, is to combat anti-Semitism, but of course they deliberately blur anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, and they regard anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism as being more or less coterminous. And they are deeply, deeply integrated with the police in this country and in the US with the FBI. Indeed, the ADL back to the 1940s, even before the creation of the State of Israel, was collaborating with the FBI and informing on people to the FBI and tried to, you know, they were spying on Arab American activists and tried to have them deported or locked up. And it's the same with the Community Security Trust here. They maintain huge files on Muslims, on people on the left, indeed on anti-Zionist Jews. You have huge files on some anti-Zionist Jews, which I've seen. And they use these to defame these people and to accuse them of being anti-Semitic, and they use them to pass on to the Home Office and indeed to the intelligence services. So there's a very strong relationship between the Zionist movement and the intelligence and police services in both this country and in the US and maybe other countries too.
Can you also say a word or two about the board members of the Abraham Global Peace Initiative, David?
Well, I mean, you see, a ragbag collection of, the film said, a rogues gallery. I mean, these are people who have very senior roles in the Zionist entity, and the Minister for Strategic Affairs, which, of course, was given the job in 2015 of being the main ministry to combat boycott, divestment and sanctions all around the world. Mm. People who've had all sorts of connections with the Israel occupation forces and indeed with, you know, the direct repression of the Palestinians, so you can see the kind of character of it from those kinds of people. And the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, who is a proud settler, that's the trajectory, isn't it? They pretend that the occupation, which they call the occupation of the West Bank and the Golan, is just some kind of thing which we no longer pay attention to, and that really all the new settlements that they're building are just a process we can't stop. Well, of course, you know, none of that's true. The occupation of the West Bank, indeed of the whole Palestine, could be reversed, and that's what we see in the future for the resistance.
Yeah. I mean, Batul, I mean, you've written, haven't you, about the reverse effects of bribe normalisation. I wonder if you could briefly tell us a little bit about your observations on that.
Sure. I think that the crux of the issue is that the Abraham Accords came up from a position of weakness and not strength. I mean, Israel was an entity that never dreamed of leaving South Lebanon in 2000 when it was forced to unilaterally withdraw, for example. In addition to 2005, when it unilaterally withdrew from Gaza, for example, we see that all the battles that it fought from 2008 to 12 to 14 to 21 have failed. And then consider also the embargoes, the sieges, the sanctions that have been on the resistance line as a whole, of course, because this is a coordinated resistance axis, right? So when all of those have failed, when the Western strategy for the region has failed, what do they resort to? They start to resort to kind of empty talks, sound bombs. And the open normalization of ties is an example of this, because it's not like the resistance has basically lost any allies, and it's not like Israel has gained any allies. Yeah. It's simply a question of relations going from being under the table to now being over the table. Yes, it might have in some respects facilitated the security, the military operations, the economic outputs and ties, but in terms of people's perceptions, if you now quiz in Egypt or Jordan, I think it was yesterday the Cradle Media released one of the polls which said that only 5% of the populations of those countries, in Egypt normalized ties back in the 80s under Anwar Sadat, and Jordan and Wadi Araba in the 1990s before Oslo, only 5%. So this shows that the hearts and the minds of the people, they know what the oppression is and the reality of it. So in many ways, this is revealing those who are walking the talk and those who are normalizing ties and lowering their heads in shame. And none of the American strategies for the region has worked. Certainly this one hasn't, and it's ultimately expired in a way, of the century.
Indeed. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed to Batul and to David, our resident expert. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
In the limelight.
Despite international standards and the admonishments of Canadian courts, Canada continues to practice different forms of abuse in its prisons. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Catherine Latimer, Executive Director of John Howard Society of Canada. This article is published under the heading, Why Does Canada Still Allow Torture in Prisons? Here's more. Eddie Nalen bled to death in a segregation cell at Millhaven Penitentiary in 1974. For every year since, prisoners have courageously marked August 10th as Prisoners' Justice Day in Canada. Despite this international standard and the admonishments of Canadian courts, Canada continues to practice this form of abuse. They fast, refuse to work, and think about all prisoners who have died. Long before the medical science backed them up, prisoners knew that being locked alone in a cell indeterminately would undermine sanity and drive them towards suicide. The consciousness of Canadians has caught up with what prisoners have known for years. Prolonged solitary confinement is torture. Canadian appellate courts in BC and Ontario have now held that indeterminate periods of isolated confinement violate charter rights. Class Nation lawsuits have been successful, resulting in damages for the cruelty prisoners experienced for being held in segregated confinement for more than 15 days straight. The United Nations defines solitary confinement as 22 hours or more alone in a cell without meaningful human contact. More than 15 consecutive days of it has been prohibited as cruel and a form of torture. Yes. Despite this international standard and the admonishments of Canadian courts, Canada continues to practice this form of abuse. In 2019, Canada repealed legislation permitting administrative segregation, one form of solitary confinement. Ministers said this would be the end of solitary confinement in Canada. They were wrong. Confinement in cells for more than 22 hours without meaningful human contact continues under different names. From dry celling to lockdowns to medical observation, the list is long. Solitary has worsened over the last 2 years with a ready public health jurisdiction for cruel confinement. Most concerning is that structured intervention units, or SIUs, that were built as the answer to abusive solitary confinement now perpetuate it. Professor Doob and Sprott's analysis of SIUs revealed that 10% of SIU placements result in prohibited, prolonged solitary confinement or torture. This finding was accepted by the Minister of Public Safety before a parliamentary committee. When parliamentarians learn that Canadians are being tortured right here at home, the practice should be stopped immediately. Canadians should not tolerate other Canadians being tortured by state officials. Stopping this is not difficult. Direct and legislate correctional authorities to cap solitary confinement at 15 consecutive days. Ratify the optional protocol against torture and denounce torture in all forms, particularly in own backyard.
The correctional investigator, auditor general, senators and advocates have raised countless failings in correctional system in Canada. They are frustrated that recommended reforms have been ignored. It would take a wholesale transformation of the federal correctional system to fully respect the rule of law and provide prisoners with the rights and justice to which they are entitled. But surely stopping practices that are recognized in international human rights documents by Canadian courts as cruel and torturous is not too much to hope for on this prisoner's justice day. How many more Eddie Nalens will Canada fail?
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the US economy destroyed US production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This, in turn, is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazyev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote, prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us. And we welcome you to the to the club now.
Well, Doctor, actually, on this point, if I may, with your permission, it's very interesting because you mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski. He actually states very clearly in his book, this was written in the late 20th century, he says that the worst scenario for America, he clearly states this, the worst scenario for America is an alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. So this is not some, like, when you are mentioning these things, when we in Iran talk about these things, these are not some sort of, you know, guesses. These are not some sort of conspiracy theories. These are things that are stated very clearly and openly by the leadership and by the elites in America. And so this is in terms of just, you know, complementing what you're saying, that, you know, it's clearly stated just as... it's very interesting for me because the things you mentioned, my specialty is strategic studies, international relations. Many of the things that you're mentioning are said, we talk about these things in strategic studies, in international relations, of course, in our own language, in our own jargon that we have. So, for example, you mentioned the British and their whole desire since the 19th century to destroy the Russian Empire. Well, again, this is clearly stated by Halford Mackinder, who is considered the father, or so-called the founding father of modern geopolitics and geostrategic studies. Of course, he was a geographer who for the first time looked at the world as one geostrategic unit and talked about the fact that whoever wants to rule the world has to control, of course, he used his own language, but what we would call today Eurasia, that if Eurasia on its own is so big and powerful and capable of... And if we look at historically, and, you know, I think there were economists in Holland that did a long-term study about this, which is that if you look at the global history, 80 to 90% of global history has been dominated in terms of the economic production and the center of civilization being in Eurasia, being in Asia. So this idea that somehow the North Atlantic or the Americans would dominate the world is actually a very strange and unusual situation that we had in human history. It's coming back to this situation where it was for centuries and for millennia. But you see people like Halford Mackinder clearly stating that their goal is to prevent any Eurasian power coming and becoming powerful and being a rival. And at that time, this is all in emphasizing the points you were making from a strategic studies perspective, that very clearly Halford Mackinder stating that the goal has to be that in no way, shape, or form should Russia and Germany be allied and be united, and that there has to always be a buffer zone between Germany and Russia, where they can exploit these petty nationalisms, where these countries can either be used against Germany or can be used against Russia. Anytime there's a danger that you would see Russia or Germany becoming powerful and then uniting in terms of strategically and economically, as you were mentioning, as was already happening end of the 19th century. The other thing that was very interesting for me, Doctor, was that actually there's serious people who would argue that the Americans, in a way, actually also had a ministry of industry that was controlling its industrial growth after World War II. It was just called the Pentagon. It wasn't called the Ministry of Industry. It was called the Ministry of Defense. So in a way, yes, they had those corporations that were, on paper, they were private. And they were, of course, private. The profits went to the oligarchs. It created an oligarchy in the United States. But its strategic coordination was done at the Pentagon. So things like the internet, things like mobile technology, mobile phones, all those technologies that we saw, you know, emerging out of the 20th century, if you trace a lot of them back, you see even things like civilian aircraft, civilian passenger flight. A lot of these things that were technologies that transformed the world technologically, if you trace back the money, you see that at some point they went back to the Pentagon and programs that were financed. And the reason is this, Doctor, and I'm so happy we're able to talk about these things on television, which is that very rarely do you have private investors willing to invest large sums of money for something that will be profitable in 10 or 20 years. This is just not something that a private investor will do. The horizon for profitability is maximum 4 to 5 years. And this is why, in reference to the new model that you are referring to in terms of the model that is being used in China or India, but also to a certain extent in Iran, which I will talk about a little bit with your permission. So what we need is, and this is exactly actually what happened in the US as well, which is that private companies were not willing to invest into technologies such as civilian airliners, such as those other advanced technologies, because it would have taken them 10, 15 years to get the profit. So the government comes in, gives them something called a government contract. This allows them to have profits and then take those profits for themselves or invest it into other areas. I think in Iran, we had a very similar experience as you were describing with China and India. Of course, I think, this is my personal view, is that the places where we made a mistake is where we sort of blindly imitated some of those bad habits that we see in the West in terms of financialing, making the economy more financial-based, not having those controls that they have in India and in China. So all this, what I want to sum up with is that a lot of the things that you are mentioning, which is very interesting, is exactly also things that in strategic studies and international relations we also talk about, in of course in our own language. And what we say in international relations or in strategic studies is that when those realities on the ground, those technologies, those real indicators of power and wealth, when they shift and the political institutions do not shift, that's when the conflict happens. So you have a reality in the world where the Americans bankrupted themselves pretty much by 2008, if you look at the financial crisis that happened in the United States. You had the so-called war on terror. I would just suggest this to you, Doctor, that actually the hybrid war, as far as the Iranians are concerned, has been going on since the 1990s. We've been experiencing all those elements that you describe as a hybrid war in Iran since the 1990s. Of course, because the scale of the conflict was smaller, maybe a lot of people in the world didn't realize this. Of course, those who were experts understood what the Americans were doing in Iran and in trying to fight Iran. All those elements that are now being used in this hybrid war against Russia and China were first used, tested, tried with Iran. And I think the interesting thing for maybe Russia and China is to look and to see how was Iran capable of resisting and not succumbing to this hybrid war. A lot of it, which of course you also indicated, which is to have that strategic management being centralized, but also taking advantage of market mechanisms and allowing both the forces that are social, but also the forces that are related to the central government being able to coordinate the different interests that exist. So with that in mind, I apologize. I just felt that there was it was very interesting to me. I wanted to add and emphasize some of the points you were saying from our perspective as strategic studies or international relations. So with that in mind, Dr. Glazeev, what does the future look like? What is it, how is it that we're going to now move away from this system dominated by what is becoming an inefficient American system, a system that is abusing that system of banking and money, which was serving it for a purpose for a period of time, and weaponizing it and using it as a political tool and weapon against different countries. One thing that maybe we could talk about is the idea that, for example, why is it that we denominate all major important commodities in the dollar? I mean, Iran has a lot of oil and gas. Russia has a lot of oil and gas. Why do we have to sell it in dollars to India and China? We are neighbors. We're on the same continent. How is it that things like dollar hegemony and those other things that are the markers of the current system, what is the future going to look like? How can we replace these things that are currently existing with new systems, and what are those new systems going to be? And if you could please, we don't have a lot more time left, just if you could give us the gist of it. Thank you very much.
I shall try to be brief. According to the long-term economic growth theory, it is quite clear that America is going to lose. It is no doubt that America will lose its leadership as well. The British Empire lost it a century ago. Not because we don't like America. It's because America has obsolete and, in fact, inefficient economic system. They use their financial opportunities. They still have hegemony in the world of finance. American dollar dominates in all transactions, which you mentioned, in the currency reserves. But it is very important that America lost its privilege to print the world money about 1 month ago. Of course, you're right that Iran is suffering from this hybrid war about 30 years. And of course, we had to look for the Iranian experience. Unfortunately, the Russian financial elite was very confident in the American state, in American policy, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian economy becomes, in fact, the peripheral economy. It was used by the Americans as a donor. And by the Europeans, yes. We exported raw materials, and we had capital flight about $100 billion per year. And the Russian economy was too much dependent from the American influence, especially the governance of the Russian central banks was controlled by the IMF, and IMF recommendations were implemented in Russia with catastrophic results. But America was too much, it was too much concentrated on Russophobia, mm-hmm. and it played a bad joke with the Americans. They used their main weapon, the dominance in the world financial system, against Russia, and they did not have any cards more. The American dollar is not considered as a reserve currency anymore in Asia. Of course, you have such experience before. For you, dollar is not reserve currency for a long time. But for Russia, and now for China as well, America, and for India, I am sure, American dollar lost its image as a world currency, and America so lost its main weapon, I should say. In this book, which I showed to you, I made some recommendations. They were written about, as I mentioned, 6 years ago. And the first recommendations was to, if you want to finish this war, if you want to save the mankind from the American aggression, we have to create coalition between those countries who are not interested in the war, who want peaceful development, and who are constructing now the new world economic mode. So we have to avoid to get rid from dollar. Get rid from dollar as a world currency in trade, in reserves, in financial transactions. For Russia and for Iran, it is no question anymore. It is no question also, I think, for China. And American superpower is undermined now because the world do not believe in American dollar anymore. And we have to move as far as possible for the national currencies in our relations. And now in our economic commission, we are trying to elaborate with the Russian academician experts, trying to elaborate the model for the new world currency. Mm-hmm. It should be based on the commodity basket. As you mentioned, Russia and Iran have dominance in the oil sector.
Exactly.
We also have dominance together in the metallurgy. in the chemical sector, in the water, in coal, in a lot of commodities, we can organize the common economic space, which will be independent from the Western benchmarks. What we are thinking about to create the Asian exchange, mm-hmm. which will generate its own prices. Prices should for all those commodities should not be generated in London or in New York. These are our commodities, and we can organize our economic space in such a way that the price formation for those commodities will satisfy our needs, not needs of the Western speculations, but the needs of the production sector.
Doctor, if I excuse me, so if I understand you correctly, we are looking maybe at a special international currency, not a national currency, but one that is backed by the national currencies and the commodities. And that, so
yes.
is this correct? Did I understand this correctly? That
yes.
this would
the
then
idea,
be.
The,
go ahead, please.
The idea is to create the new world currency, which could be used for the border transactions. This currency should be constructed on the basis of the basket of the national currencies mm-hmm. of those countries which are involved in this process, like a special development, special deposit rights. Of the IMF,
yes,
but on the basis of the another principles, more fair and more clear, and another part of this currency should be the basket of commodities. If you combine together the basket of national currencies and basket of commodities, and create the synthetic currency based on this about 30 subjects in the basket, we can go. We can create a very a strong currency, which will be very stable, in spite of all the international conjuncture.
So, excuse me, Doctor. So let me understand you correctly. So, this currency is not a currency that we in different countries would be having in our wallets in our bank accounts. We would still be using our national accounts. This would be a purely international currency used by for the transaction between countries for the sale of the commodities that exist, that it would be backed by the power of the national currencies and by the commodities that are so abundant in Asia. Which is interesting because you talked about fiat money. It's actually very, very new that we have fiat money. For throughout human history, we actually had commodity-backed money. We had money that there was something that people could back it with. So this is going back to that in a certain way. Going back to that.
Yes, but you are quite right. In international transactions, if you are speaking about the national economies, each country has its own national currency.
Very good.
Fiat currency, which can be used for monetary support of the investment activity, but the currency which I'm talking about is the currency for international transactions. Of course, we need some kind of organization like that. For instance, in BRICS, we have the basket of the reserve currencies of BRICS. We can involve BRICS countries as well, not only Asian countries, but let's take also Brazil and South Africa, use the BRICS organization. So the idea is to get rid from any kind of private monopoly on the world money. The new world money should be created on the basis of international treaty. This is the first foundation of the new economic world economic structure. The second foundation is the information technologies. As you know, the American Agency of National Security is the cyber terrorist number one in the world. Mm-hmm. Almost about half of cyber attacks are coming from the United States, from the one place, Agency of National Security. The United States is the only country which don't want to sign the International Treaty for Cybersecurity. So our peace coalition should also has another, not only monetary treaty, but also treaty on information technologies, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism. And those countries, like the United States, who doesn't want to sign this agreement and to fulfill this agreement, should be under our sanctions. So we shouldn't use information technologies which are developed by the countries who sponsor the cyber terrorism, like the United States and Great Britain. This is the second foundation. And the third foundation, which becomes also very actual. As you know, the Americans is the only country in the world which openly violates the International Convention Against the Biological Weapons. As we have seen in Ukraine, the Americans were conducting the elaboration of the biological weapons using the Ukrainian population. So the COVID pandemic is also part of this biological war. So our coalition of the countries which want to finish this hybrid war and to create opportunities for the peaceful, sustainable economic growth, to my mind, should have three basic foundations. The first one is the Treaty Convention on the Issuer and Devolved Money, which I described. The second one, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism, which will regulate the use of information technologies in the world. And the third one, the Convention on the Control over the Fulfillment of the Convention on Biological Security. So these are three foundations will be enough to create a very powerful worldwide coalition against American aggression. And I think here in Asia, we can be able to create new architecture, financial architecture, trade architecture of economic relations, which will be based on the mutual interests, which will be based on the international law, and which will be quite different from the liberal globalization led by Washington, because each country has its sovereign rights to elaborate those type of regulation of economy which is adequate to its cultural heritage, to the people's norms of behavior, and the diversity of the economic national systems is also the part of this new world economic mode. The main idea of international relations should be creation opportunities for the growth of investments, not trade liberalization, not currency liberalization, but creation of more opportunities for economic growth, for the growth of the well-being of societies, for the growth of the real incomes of the population. So I think together we can organize such kind of new economic mode, which will be attractive for the whole world.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much. We've run out of time, unfortunately. It was very interesting talking to you. And on that positive note, thank you so much. And hopefully, if there's opportunity arises, we can continue this discussion at a later time. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Glazev? If we look at the issue from the perspective of long-term economic cycles analysis, the era of U.S. economic power is coming to an end, and a new era of economic power based in Asia, particularly in China and India, is beginning because of more efficient production models that have been established there in recent years, combining centralized strategic planning with market forces and the channeling of profits into production as opposed to channeling them into the personal wealth of a few wealthy oligarchs. In contrast, the U.S. has shifted from a production-based economy to a financially dominated economy, characterized by extreme wealth gaps and the channeling of profits into the hands of a few oligarchs and into offshore tax havens, instead of into the expansion of production and jobs, an issue central to the Trump and America First campaign and presidency, and one of the keys to understanding the current social and political conflict that exists domestically in the U.S. We can add to this America's endless global war against terror that has been going on for more than 20 years and which has morally and infrastructurally bankrupted the U.S. with trillions of dollars spent on foreign wars while basic needs and infrastructure are at a third world level in many parts of the United States. We can further add to this the fact that the Western-dominated global financial and banking systems are losing credibility because of their weaponization by the U.S. to wage economic war against its global rivals and enemies, thus accelerating the emergence of a new non-Western global financial and banking system that allows countries to engage in trade and commerce outside of U.S. dollar hegemony. The geostrategic alignment of China, Russia, and Iran, which the late American geostrategist